This is Kathy bringing you the Herald and Review for Decatur and area for Monday, December the 1st. We may pop over and pick up some Sunday news also. The special report on health. They relied on marijuana to get through the day, but then the days felt impossible without it. For the past several years, 75-year-old Miguel LeBoy has smoked a joint with his coffee every morning. He tells himself he won't start tomorrow the same way, but he usually does. "You know what bothers me? To have cannabis on my mind the first thing in the morning," he said, sparking a blunt in his Brookline, Massachusetts apartment. "I'd like to get up one day and not smoke, but you see how it's going." Since legalization and commercialization, daily cannabis use has become a defining and often invisible part of many people's lives. High-potency vapes and concentrates now dominate the market, and doctors say they can blur the line between relief and dependence over time so that users don't notice the shift. Alcohol remains more widely used than cannabis, but starting in 2022, the number of daily cannabis users in the U.S. surpassed that of daily drinkers, a major shift in American habits. Researchers say the rise unfolded alongside products that contain far more THC than the marijuana of past decades, including vape oils and concentrates that can reach 80% to 95% THC. Massachusetts, like most states, sets no limit on how strong these products can be. Doctors warn that daily high-potency use can cloud memory, disturb sleep, intensify anxiety or depression, and trigger addiction in ways earlier generations didn't encounter. Many who develop cannabis use disorder say it's hard to recognize the signs because of the widespread belief that marijuana isn't addictive. Because the consequences tend to creep in gradually, brain fog, irritability, and dependence, users often miss when therapeutic use shifts into compulsion. How a habit grows. LeBoy, a retired chef, began seeing a substance use counselor after telling his doctor he felt depressed, unmotivated, and increasingly isolated as his drinking and cannabis use escalated. Naltrexone helped him quit alcohol, but he hasn't found a way to quit marijuana. Unlike alcohol and opioids, there is no FDA-approved medication to treat cannabis addiction, although research is underway. LeBoy, who first smoked at 18, said marijuana has long soothed symptoms tied to undiagnosed ADHD, childhood trauma, and painful experiences, including cancer treatment and his son's death. Through decades in restaurant kitchens, he considered himself a functional pothead. Lately, though, his use has become compulsive. After retiring, he began vaping 85% THC cartridges. "These days, I carry two things in my hands, my vape and my cellular. That's it," he said. "I'm not proud of it, but that's reality." Cannabis eases his anxiety and settles his spirit, but he's noticed it affects his concentration. He hopes to learn to read music, but sustaining focus on the piano has grown difficult. Younger users describe a similar slide, one that begins with relief and ends somewhere harder to define: brain fog. Kyle, a 20-year-old Boston University student, said cannabis helps him manage panic attacks he's had since high school. He spoke on the condition that only his first name be used because he buys cannabis illegally. In the Austin apartment he shares with fraternity brothers, they have a communal bong. When he's high, Kyle feels strong and able to process anxious thoughts and feel a sense of gratitude, but that clarity has become harder to reach when he's sober. "I think I was able to do that better a year ago," he said. "Now I can only do it when I'm high, which is scary." He said the brain fog and feeling of detachment develop so gradually that they become your new normal. Some mornings he wakes up feeling like an observer in his own life, struggling to recall the day before. "It can be tough to wake up and go, 'Oh my God, who am I?'" he said. Still, he doesn't plan to stop anytime soon. Kyle says cannabis helps him function, more than seeking professional treatment would. Doctors say that ambivalence is common. Many people feel cannabis is both the problem and the solution. Legalization. Anne Hassel spent a month in jail and a year on probation for growing cannabis in the 1980s. She cried when Massachusetts' first dispensaries opened, and left her physical therapy career to get a job at one. "Within a year, though, my dream job turned into a nightmare," she said. Hessel, 58, said some consultants pushed staff to promote high-potency concentrates as more medicinal, downplaying their risks. She began using 90% THC concentrate several times a day. Her use quickly became debilitating, she said. She lost interest in things she once loved, like mountain biking. One autumn day, she drove to the woods and turned back without getting out. She didn't seek formal treatment, but recovered with the help of a friend. Riding her green motorcycle, once named Sativa, after her favorite strain, has helped her reconnect to her body and spirit. People don't want to acknowledge what's going on because legalization was tied to social justice, she said. You get swept up in it and don't recognize the harm until it's too late. What doctors say? Dr. Jordan Tischler, a former emergency physician who now treats medical cannabis patients in Massachusetts, said that low doses of THC paired with high doses of CBD can help some patients with anxiety. Many products have high levels of THC, which can worsen symptoms, he said. It's a medicine, he said. It can be useful, but it can also be dangerous, and access without guidance is dangerous. Dr. Kevin Hill, an addiction director at Boston's Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, who specializes in cannabis use disorder, said the biggest gap is education among both consumers and clinicians. I think adults should be allowed to do what they want as long as it doesn't hurt anyone else, but many users don't understand the risks, he said. He said the conversion shouldn't be about prohibition, but about balance and informed decision-making. For most people, the risks outweigh the benefits. And this front page article, Rubio says that the U.S.-Ukraine talks on Russia war were productive, but much work remains in search of a deal. From Hollandale Beach, Florida. U.S. and Ukrainian officials completed roughly 4 hours of talks Sunday, aimed at finding an endgame to the war between Russia and Ukraine, just days before a U.S. envoy was due in Moscow for talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Secretary of State Marco Rubio told reporters afterward that the session with the Ukrainian team in Florida was productive, but work remains in the search for a peace deal. It's not just about the terms that end fighting, Rubio said. It's about also the terms that set up Ukraine for long-term prosperity. I think we built on that today, but there's more work to be done. President Donald Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, is scheduled to meet with Putin in Moscow in the next few days. Rubio, Witkoff, and Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, represented the American side in the high-level talks, held at a sensitive time as Ukraine continues to push back against the Russian forces that invaded in 2022 while dealing with a domestic corruption scandal. Diplomats have focused on revisions to a proposed U.S.-authored plan that was developed in negotiations between Washington and Moscow. That plan has been criticized as being too weighted toward Russian demands. As the meeting began Sunday, Rubio focused on reassuring Ukraine. The end goal is obviously not just the end of the war, Rubio said, but it's also about securing an end to the war that leaves Ukraine sovereign and independent and with an opportunity at real prosperity. This is not just about peace deals, the top American diplomat said, as the team sat down in the Shell Bay Club, a golf and racket club developed by Witkoff at Hallandale Beach. Rustem Umerov, head of Ukraine's Security Council, responded to Rubio by expressing his country's appreciation for U.S. efforts, a message geared toward Trump, who has at times claimed that Ukraine has not been sufficiently grateful for U.S. assistance during the war. U.S. is hearing us, Umerov said. U.S. is supporting us. U.S. is working beside us. Umerov, who appeared with Rubio to deliver a brief statement to reporters after the talks, underscored Ukraine's gratitude for U.S. support during the nearly four-year war, but he offered no hints about what, if any, progress was made during the talks. Our objective is a prosperous, strong Ukraine, Umerov said. We discussed all the important matters that are important for Ukraine, for Ukrainian people, and the U.S. was super supportive. Rubio said the talks were comprehensive and went beyond finding agreement to end the fighting. Trump has repeatedly said that if Ukraine builds deeper commercial ties to the United States, it can help deter Russian aggression in the future. To that end, the U.S. and Ukraine earlier this year signed an agreement granting American access to Ukraine's vast mineral resources. Among measures included in Trump's draft peace proposal is the creation of a Ukraine development fund to invest in fast-growing industries, including technology, data centers, and artificial intelligence. The proposal also calls for Washington to cooperate with Kiev to jointly rebuild, develop, modernize, and operate Ukraine's natural gas infrastructure, including pipelines and storage facilities. Russia has repeatedly bombarded Ukraine's energy infrastructure during the war. We also want to help Ukraine be safe forever, so never again will they face another invasion. And equally importantly, we want them to enter an age of true prosperity, Rubio said. We want the Ukrainian people to emerge from this war, not just to rebuild their country, but to build it back in a way that will be stronger and more prosperous than this ever has been. Umerov has been involved in the talks, but until now, Ukraine's head negotiator had been Andriy Yermak, the powerful chief of staff of Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. On Friday, Zelensky announced the resignation of Yermak after his home was searched by anti-corruption investigators. Zelensky's government has been roiled by fallout from a scandal over a $100 million embezzlement from the energy sector through kickbacks paid by contractors, causing newfound domestic pressures for Zelensky. It was only a week ago that Rubio met with Yermak in Geneva, with each side saying the talks had been positive in putting together a revised peace plan. Among other members of the Ukrainian delegation were Andriy Hanatov, the head of Ukraine's armed forces, and presidential advisor Alexander Bevs. The plan, which Trump has since played down as concept or a map to be fine-tuned, would impose limits on the size of Ukraine's military, block the country from joining NATO, and requiring Ukraine to hold elections in 100 days. Negotiators indicated the framework has changed, but it's not clear how its provisions have been altered. It had initially envisioned Ukraine ceding the entire eastern region of the Donbas to Russia, a sticking point for Kiev. Trump said on Tuesday that he would send Witkoff and perhaps Kushner to Moscow this week to meet with Putin about the plan. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov, in comments published Sunday on Russian state television, said Putin would see Witkoff before Thursday when Putin departs for India. Both Witkoff and Kushner, like Trump, hail from the world of real estate that values deal-making over the conventions of diplomacy. The pair were also behind a 20-point proposal that led to a ceasefire in Gaza. Zelensky wrote on X that the Ukrainian delegation would swiftly and substantively work out the steps needed to end the war. In his nightly address on Saturday, Zelensky said the American side was demonstrating a constructive approach. In the coming days, it is feasible to flesh out the steps to determine how to bring the war to a dignified end, he said. And we have some more world news on the front page about the Afghanistan war. The program brought in refugees who fought the Taliban. Trump criticizes that program. The man accused of shooting two National Guard members in Washington is one of about 76,000 Afghans brought to the United States after the chaotic withdrawal of the U.S. from their country as the Taliban took over, authorities said. The program, called Operation Allies Welcome, was created after the 2021 decision to leave Afghanistan following 20 years of American intervention and billions of dollars of aid. Democratic President Joe Biden, who oversaw the withdrawal started by his predecessor, Republican President Donald Trump, said the U.S. owed it to the interpreters and translators and fighters and drivers and others who opposed the Taliban to give them a safe place outside of Afghanistan. Others, including Trump and many Republicans, claim the refugees were not properly vetted in a resettlement process that, and they said, was as chaotic and poorly planned as leaving the country to the Taliban. This individual and so many others should have never been allowed to come here, CIA Director John Ratcliffe said. The accused shooter, identified by law enforcement officials as Ramanulala Lakhanwal, worked with the CIA as a member of a partner force in Kandahar, Ratcliffe said in a statement Thursday. It didn't specify what Lakhanwal did for the American spy agency. The Kandahar region in southern Afghanistan was in the Taliban heartland of the country and saw fierce fighting between the Taliban and NATO forces after the U.S.-led invasion in 2021, following the Al-Qaeda attacks on September 11th. The CIA relied on Afghan staff for translation, administrative, and frontline fighting with their own paramilitary officers in the war. Little is known about Lakhanwal's 4 years in the U.S. or why he drove across the country from his home in Bellingham, Washington, where a former landlord said he lived with his wife and five children. Luckenwal was granted asylum in April under Trump administration, according to Afghan EVAC, a group of veterans and others working to get Afghans who helped the U.S. out of the country in exchange for their help. Like all asylum seekers, he would have had to undergo fingerprinting and iris scans, a full background check and interview, and a risk assessment, the organization said. Groups that help resettle Afghans said their actions of one man shouldn't reflect negatively on the tens of thousands who went through the various legal pathways to resettling in the U.S. and the others who find themselves in limbo after Trump suspended almost all resettlement programs for nations across the world when he took office in January. "I don't want people to leverage this tragedy into a political ploy," said Sean Van Driver, president of Afghan EVAC. After leaving Afghanistan, tens of thousands of those seeking resettlement ended up in sprawling tent villages at military bases like Joint Base McGuire-Dix-Lakehurst in central New Jersey, Fort McCoy in Wisconsin, or in Fort Bliss in Texas. After months of health screenings and background checks, many were resettled and established Afghan communities in Northern Virginia and the surrounding Washington area, as well as Northern California and Texas. States where between 1,000 and 3,000 have settled include Arizona, New York, Florida, Georgia, Colorado, Nebraska, Pennsylvania, according to the State Department data. Trump's executive order shortly after taking office in January, suspending federal funding for resettlement agencies, made it tougher to help refugees with basic necessities like food and rent, handcuffing the most religious groups that help them. The president, who described Afghanistan as hellhole on earth, already planned to review every Afghan who entered the country under Operation Allies Welcome and reiterated that goal after Wednesday's shooting. "If they can't love our country, we don't want them," Trump said on social media, adding that the shooting was a crime against our entire nation. Trump also used his message to attack refugees from Somalia who have settled in Minnesota, saying they are ripping apart that once great state. "It's part of this administration's goal to both deport people in the country illegally and close the country to most refugees," Trump said. "He wants to remove anyone who does not belong here or does not add benefit to our country." One of the Afghans who made it to the U.S. was Mohammed Sabur, a father of seven children, worked as an electrician and an AC technician with international U.S. forces for 17 years. He resettled this year in California and told the Associated Press he looked forward to sending his kids to school and giving back to the country that took his family in. "I believe that now we can live in a 100% peaceful environment," Sabur said. Crews are restoring power in Wisconsin while Iowa airport reopens after plane left the icy runway. Travelers at the end of the Thanksgiving holiday on Sunday were finding hundreds of flights delayed and canceled in Chicago following a winter storm in the Great Lakes region while a wintry mix of rain and snow developed in the Northeast. In Wisconsin, utility crews worked to restore power to thousands of people while the airport in Des Moines, Iowa, reopened on the critical travel day after a Delta Connection flight landing from Detroit slid off an icy runway. No injuries were reported and passengers were transported to the terminal by bus. Hundreds of churches in western Michigan told worshipers to stay home or watch services online. Up to 12 inches of snow had fallen since Saturday in areas close to Lake Michigan. On Saturday, 8.4 inches of snow fell at Chicago O'Hare International Airport, setting a record for the highest single calendar day snowfall in November at the airport, according to the National Weather Service. That broke the previous record of 8 inches on November 6, 1951. Over 250 flights into and out of O'Hare were canceled by early afternoon, while over 1,000 were delayed, according to the tracking site FlightAware. The Federal Aviation Administration said Sunday afternoon that departures to O'Hare were delayed on average by nearly an hour due to snow or ice, and that departures from the airport were delayed an average of 15 minutes, and that was increasing due to the weather. Planes were being de-iced at several airports across the country on Sunday, including Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport and Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport, according to the FAA. On Sunday afternoon, there were about 340 flights into and out of the Detroit Metro Airport that were delayed and about two dozen canceled. In Wisconsin, We Energies reported that 6,000 power outages, with more than half in Milwaukee and South Milwaukee, Mark Palladino said on Facebook that he was shoveling snow Sunday when his apartment complex lost power in Fredonia. Others said power lines were sagging under heavy, wet snow. Elsewhere in Iowa, gusty winds Sunday were blowing snow back onto the roads, extending hazardous travel conditions, the National Weather Service said. We did have areas of Iowa and Illinois that saw over 1 foot of snow, including 15 inches in Fort Dodge, Iowa, said meteorologist Andrew Orison. He said snow in the Great Lakes region was tapering off, but a new storm was heading into the mid-Atlantic and northeast with up to a foot of snow by Tuesday. It's going to be the first forced snowfall of the season for many of those areas, and it's going to be rather significant, Orison said. The good news is it does not look like the major cities at this point are going to be looking at any significant snowfall. And a little bit of local news. Decatur man arrested after sink ripped from the gas station wall. A Decatur man's story that he fell and accidentally ripped a big bathroom sink off the wall didn't wash with gas station employees or the cops who arrested him. Sergeant Adam Seifman in Decatur Police Department said patrol officers had been called to the Circle K station in the 500 block of North Main Street just after 1 a.m. Sunday. The suspect had come out of the bathroom and told the clerk that he fell, which caused the sink to separate from the wall and fall to the floor, said Seifman. Another employee opened the door to the men's bathroom while he observed the sink on the floor and water spewing from the wall. The 50-year-old man then left the gas station, but Seifman said officers went looking for him and stopped and arrested him a few blocks away from the station. He was booked on a preliminary charge of criminal damage and issued a notice to appear in court. All preliminary charges are subject to review by the Office of the State's Attorney. And back to international news. Hong Kong mourns, investigates after the fire. Hong Kong's deadliest fire in decades raised questions about corruption and negligence in the renovations of the apartment complex, where at least 128 people died. An intense fire broke out at Wang Fuk Court Complex in Hong Kong's southern suburbs Wednesday afternoon, with flames covering 7 of the 8 towers. The complex was home to about 4,800 residents, some of whom had raised safety concerns about the renovations more than a year before the fire. Police on Wednesday arrested 3 men from a construction company on suspicion of manslaughter and gross negligence. They were released on bail, but then arrested by the Independent Commission Against Corruption. The authorities said Saturday night, pointing to their leadership role in the renovations. ICAC also previously arrested 7 men and 1 woman associated with the project. Police have not identified the company where the suspects worked, but the documents posted to the Homeowners Association website showed that the Prestige Construction and Engineering Company was in charge of renovations. Police seized boxes of documents from the company where phones rang unanswered on Thursday. Officials also said they were investigating the materials used, both the netting on the scaffolding and the foam panels covering windows, and their role in the blaze. For almost a year, some residents of the Wang Fuk Court complex raised safety concerns to Hong Kong authorities about the scaffolding materials used in the renovation project, according to documents reviewed by the AP, specifically about the netting that covered the scaffolding. Hong Kong's Labor Department, in a statement Saturday, confirmed it received such complaints, adding that officials carried out 16 inspections of Wang Fuk Court's renovation project since July 2024 and warned contractors multiple times in writing that they must ensure that they met fire safety requirements. The city even carried out an independent inspection as recently as 1 week before the fire. The Labor Department said it reviewed the product quality certificate of the netting and it was in line with standards, but the safety netting had not been the previous target of inspections. Preliminary investigation showed that the fire started on a lower-level scaffolding net of one of the buildings. It then spread rapidly as the foam panels caught fire, said Chris Tang, the city's secretary for security. Police said they were also looking at the highly flammable foam panels. The blaze ignited the foam panels, causing the glass to shatter and leading to a swift intensification of the fire and its spread into the interior spaces, Tang said. The Labor Department said later Saturday that 3 prosecutions were brought against the company over breaches of safety regulations for working at a height in a construction and convictions in 2 of the cases, resulting in fines totaling $3,850. The company was also fined three times in 2023 for separate violations unrelated to the Taipo project. First responders also found some fire alarms in the complex, which housed many older people, did not sound when tested, said Andy Young, the director of Hong Kong Fire Services. He did not specify how many were not working or if any of the other devices were. It took firefighters a day to bring the fire under control, and it was not fully extinguished until Friday morning, about 40 hours after it started. Crews prioritized apartments from which they received emergency calls during the blaze, but were unable to reach in the hours that the fire burned out of control. Derek Armstrong Chan, a deputy director of Hong Kong Fire Services, told reporters, 12 firefighters were among the 79 people injured in the blaze, and one firefighter was killed. 2 days after the fire began, smoke continued to drift out of the charred skeletons of the buildings from the occasional flare-up. More bodies might be recovered, authorities said. Crews finished their search for anyone living trapped inside. Authorities said Saturday they needed to identify 44 more bodies out of the 128 recovered. About 150 people remain unaccounted for. Near the site of the fire, Sarah Yu held the hand of her 2-year-old son, Dominic, as they each placed a single white rose into a growing cluster of the flowers in the small children's playground. I brought the kids here because I wanted them to understand that living in this world is something to be cherished, she said, holding back tears. Outside a building close to the scene of the fire where family members came to identify loved ones from photographs, people placed bouquets of white roses, lilies, and carnations. More than 128 innocent lives. What did they do wrong? Asked a sign placed among the flowers. The city lowered flags to half staff in mourning, and Chief Executive John Lee held a 3-minute silence Saturday from the government headquarters with officials all dressed in black. Some of pieces that are of international news. Israeli PM asks for a corruption pardon. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu asked the country's president Sunday to grant him a pardon from corruption charges, seeking to end a long-running trial that has bitterly divided the nation. Netanyahu, who has been at war against Israel's legal system over the charges, said the request would help unify the country at a time of momentous change in the region, but it immediately triggered denunciations from opponents, who said a pardon would weaken democratic institutions and send a dangerous message that he's above the rule of law. Netanyahu had submitted a request for a pardon to the legal department of the office of the president, the prime minister's office said in a statement. The president's office called it an extraordinary request, carrying with it significant implications. Officials, Indonesians steal food and water to live. Some residents of the flood-hit Indonesian island of Sumatra resorted to stealing food and water to survive, authorities said Sunday, while Sri Lankan officials said deaths from floods and mudslides in that island nation have risen to 193. The floods, which hit Indonesia nearly a week ago, killed 442 people, with the number expected to rise as more bodies are recovered, and displaced 290,700 people, as nearly 3,000 houses were damaged, including 827 that were flattened, or swept out by floods. The deluges triggered landslides, damaged roads, cut off parts of the island, and downed communication lines. And I think we'll stop right there. That's the end of part one. I'll be right back with part two. Stay tuned.